Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to hear from a chef who's being feted. We'll hear about a chef who just bought a Burlington bakery and cafe. We're going to talk to an artist whose work hangs on the exterior of a Waterbury cafe. In between, we'll learn about a new study on milkweed. We'll check in with national correspondent Bob Ney. But let's talk to our chef to get things rolling. About a month ago, I had a couple of people producing beer and spirits at Black Flannel Brewing and Distilling in Essex. I had them on the show. During the interview, I mentioned the outstanding food service there. Well, from my mouth to the ears of the James Beard Foundation, Black Flannel's executive chef Christian Cruz was recently chosen as a semifinalist in the Best Chef in the Northeast category. And he joins us now to talk about his career and this honor. Chef, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick, for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Listeners, to ask Chef Cruz a question or to share a meal you've enjoyed at Black Flannel, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Before you attended NECI, had you been working in any restaurants? Were you in the business already?
Yeah, I started at Pauline's Cafe on Shelburne Road.
Oh, yeah.
I worked for Dave Haney there before I went to culinary school, and I applied there. You know, they said it would be great to get some kitchen experience because I didn't have any. So I spent about 6 months to a year there. So that's kind of where it really started before culinary school.
But what was it that you knew this was what you wanted to do as your career, Christian?
I think, two things. I went to college for a year. I attended Merrimack College in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and just wasn't a fit for me. And then I came back to Vermont, took some time off, and, was having a conversation with my dad. And, you know, he was like, you know, what about going to culinary school? And I didn't understand at that time that, you know, there was, you know, this profession or opportunity to go learn how to cook, for a restaurant. So that was kind of the first introduction. But really, when I really knew that this was going to be a profession for me was when I was at NECI at the Essex campus here, and I was in my first class. It was like the stocks and sauce making class, and my chef was Dina Altieri, and we were stayed after class to skim the fat off of making chicken stock. And, mm-hmm. She looked right at me and was like, you know, if you continue working hard, like this, you'll be a great chef someday. And just those words to me at the time in my life, just not knowing, you know, kind of what I wanted to do, to hear that was just such a huge inspiration. I remember, you know, coming home to my dad and being like, Dad, you know, the chef just said I'm going to be this amazing chef someday. And, just kind of from there, just kind of skyrocketed forward and kind of brought me to where I am today.
Incredible what a nod from a mentor like that can do, right? And spur you on. Attending NECI, what would you say were the most important lessons that you learned there?
I think, discipline, structure in the kitchen. And, you know, for someone like me, I didn't really have that other than kind of at home. So that kind of really helped me and inspired me. But just seeing the creativity and working with all the different chefs and all the different classes, whether it was, you know, meat fabrication, cafeteria, you know, line cooking at the restaurant downtown in Burlington or doing catering, it opened up my eyes of what food is about. And it wasn't just, you know, the restaurant per se or what's on the plate, the camaraderie in the kitchen that you build with the staff, the inspiration, the creativity. So that really, really was like, okay, this is definitely for me.
Yeah. Now, you've worked at three well-respected establishments close to Lake Champlain as executive chef at Basin Harbor Club. What type of menu did you try to present for members and guests there?
It was eclectic, and it was a wide range. You know, we did a lot of buffets. We had a fine dining restaurant. We had a tavern. You know, a golf course. We did, dining on by the lake. It was called North Dock. And so my menus were different, you know, but I had chefs that ran each place, and, you know, I would sit down with them, and we'd be creative and come up every season with new flavor profiling or whatever inspired us from, you know, the winters, you know, being off of what we wanted to showcase. So each place had its own identity, which has actually really helped me in my career to this day to, you know, just have that kind of wide range knowledge and experience, which I, you know, I certainly bring here to Black Flannel.
Yeah. Well, in between, you had Virgin's Laundry, which kind of, yeah, I would think required a reimagining of what that business had been. So what did you do there, Christian?
Sure. I bought that October 2017. It was an opportunity to, you know, purchase my own restaurant. And, you know, it was a bakery, well-known bakery, and they did a great job, an amazing job. And I wanted to somewhat continue what they were doing, but also, you know, incorporate doing brunches and dinners, which was something with, you know, more my background and my interests. So I, you know, I hired a baker, multiple bakers, and did that for about 2.5 years, and just really wanted to showcase my ability to the locals, and hopefully, you know, had drawn in people from outside of Virgin's.
Well, now you're at Black Flannel, and it seems to me you push the menu here to be more than, you know, it's a brew pub, so you really do push it to be more than your typical bar food menu there. So what have you brought to Black Flannel?
Sure. When I came on board and had my initial conversations with Chris Kessler, you know, the owner, founder, you know, we had conversations about what they were doing at the moment and what he was looking for moving forward. And he was, you know, we were looking for a chef that just wants to come in, be creative, and, you know, push the boundaries of what a brew pub serves. And so that's essentially what I did, and pretty much gave him sample ideas, menus, that I said, look, I think this would help, you know, bring a different identity of what really a brewery and a distillery serves, because, you know, we are unique in the state where we're the only restaurant, distillery and brewery in the state of Vermont. So,
yeah,
that makes us exceptional. We stand out. So, you know, my goal with the food here is to just continuously every week, you know, push my staff, my cooks, my sous chefs to be creative and, you know, to tell them that there's no boundaries with food and creativity. So, you know, our menu changes almost 25 to 50% every week, and a lot of it is them, and I help them create these dishes and the recipes themselves. And you know, we do a lot of teaching, a lot of learning here, and it's just nice to be able to be at a place where you do have that kind of creative freedom.
Yeah, and I will say the first time I got there, you know, I thought, okay, it'll be standard brew pub fare, which is great, you know, and we ordered, you know, a bunch of different things and started trying things. And there was that moment you're like, what? What is going on here? Now, so Christian, for anyone who hasn't been there yet, what are a few things you'd like them to try to really experience what you've brought to the menu at Black Flannel?
Sure. I mean, we have, you know, we definitely have our classic dishes, like, you know, our smash burger. We have our fish and chips. We have a bunch of nice little snacks that we do in-house. But also, you know, we have really amazing mussel dish here. You know, we've got our smoked duck. We have a smoker in-house, so we do a lot of our smoked items in there. We've got our Argentinian grill, which is unique and special. So, you know, we certainly currently have flank steak. Yesterday we just did our wonderful St. Patty's Day corned beef dish, which was amazing. Yeah, so like the smoked duck, and yeah, that's kind of pretty much what I like to highlight in my menu.
Now, your ethnic background, it's hard to find somebody with Filipino, Danish, and French Canadian in their background. You know, I don't know if you've ever run into anybody else with that background, but what do you draw from those heritages in your cooking?
Sure. Yeah. You know, my mom, I was born in the Philippines, and my dad was born in Staten Island, but was raised up in Montreal. My grandmother's French Canadian, And then my grandfather was from Denmark. So, you know, I was growing up with all the different cultures. When it came to food, you know, food was all about this gathering and sharing and family get together. And so I grew up with that. You know, I grew up here in Westford, Vermont. You know, my parents currently still live there. But I mean, it was on a weekly basis. I mean, multiple times a week, you know, we would get together, whether it was my grandparents cooking dinner or lunch or my parents cooking, you know, dinner or lunch. I was certainly exposed at a very young age when it came to food. I mean, like everybody else, but mine, I just felt with, you know, my mom bringing Filipino culture, my grandmother, the French Canadian, and my grandfather with that kind of Scandinavian, you know, influence. I just was exposed to different cultures at a very young age, which has helped my cuisine and my flavor profiling as I get older and continue.
So it made you more adventurous at a younger age to try things?
Yeah.
Is that what was happening?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I was trying things that, you know, probably people have never tried before at the age of seven, eight. You know, I definitely had the privilege to travel the world. My parents, you know, brought me to France, Denmark, England, Portugal. So I was exposed to some really amazing food at a young age, which has helped my palate. So that's why I'm a firm believer of, you know, at least trying everything once. You don't necessarily have to like it after that, but you know, as a chef for me, I think it's very important to have that kind of understanding and respect for ingredients.
Hear, hear. That's what the ethos I live by. But it really is, you can tell from, you know, what's happening at Black Flannel, where that experience comes from. And also why you kind of knew that heading into the culinary world was right for you. Christian, roasted beets, man. Roasted beets. We were blown away by
you. Thank you.
Right? What is going on there?
You know, beets, I love beets so much. And it's funny, a lot of my chef friends and, you know, a lot of my coworkers, you know, they make fun of me because they're like, "Chef, I see every single menu that you have, you just have beets." And I'm like, well, because I love beets. I love cooking beets. I love, you know, it's very simplistic in flavor, but, you know, the additional ingredients that you add to it can just really elevate, you know, the flavor of beets. And it just goes so well with many dishes. And, you know, I grew up eating beets as a kid. So that's kind of where and why I have beets on my menu all the time. And they get fun of it.
Yeah, but I ate them out of a can with the juice running all over everything else, and it was a pain. And if my young self could eat those roasted beets, I'd probably have beets at every meal. It was really amazing. What does it mean to you to be named as a semifinalist for Best Chef in the Northeast by the James Beard Foundation?
It's amazing. You know, it's something that I've been working hard towards for a long time. You know, it's certainly an honor to be, you know, recognized for, you know, the food that I create, but also, you know, kind of just the years of experience and, you know, hard work that I've put into my craft. So, you know, I'm very blessed and it's a huge accomplishment. And, you know, I hope to show, you know, my staff and other cooks here, you know, especially here in Vermont that, you know, anything's possible. And, you know, with hard work, creativity and passion and drive, you know, you can achieve anything. So, you know, I have, and I'm very happy and my staff's happy behind me, you know, and my family. So,
How do you hear about it? Where were you when the announcement came out?
Oh yeah, that's a funny story. So, you know, it came out, well, like three or so weeks ago, and I was on a trip with, my kids. We'd gone to Boston and then we were in Lake George and, it was a Wednesday and I thought the announcement was going to come on Sunday. And so I was in Lake George, there with my kids and get a phone call from Chris Kessler. And, you know, I thought something happened in the kitchen. We had some issues in the morning that I was communicating and then he calls and he's like, "Hey, did you hear?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, I heard that our freezer broke down." And he's like, "No, you made it, man, the James Beard." And I was like, "What?" Yeah, it was just super, super accomplishing to have that feeling. And I just, my jaw dropped and like, just kind of that euphoria of, wow, like I finally did it, you know? So, it was super, super awesome to hear that news.
Well, now, Christian, this is not the first time the James Beard folks have singled you out. In 2016, you were named as Vermont Chef of the Year and were invited to cook at the James Beard House in New York City. How big a deal was that?
That year was huge for me. You know, at the time I was, you know, my fourth, fifth year of being executive chef at Basin Harbor, and you know, getting that email phone call from the James Beard House, you know, to come down and cook. You know, they invited at the time chefs on a daily basis to come and cook for guests, and you know, it's something that a lot of chefs, I believe, you know, it would be an honor to be invited to cook down there. And when I did, I mean, it was a huge accomplishment. So we went down there, a couple of my cooks, and we prepared the food up here in Vermont and then cooked a dinner down in New York City. And then shortly after that, you know, to be voted as Chef of the Year in Vermont by the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, you know, it was huge. It was very rewarding, you know, for the hard work that I was doing. And I would say at that time when I got invited to cook down at the James Beard House, I felt that I, you know, if I kept cooking at a high level and just being, you know, keep being creative, that I had a shot at some point down the road of, you know, being nominated, you know, by the James Beard Foundation. So.
Do you remember what you served at the James Beard House? And of course, I've got to ask, did the dish include beets?
yes, actually, that's so funny. Yes, it did. But yeah, we did I think it was a butternut squash soup. I believe we did, we had a pork belly dish with like a pear puree. And then I think it was a lamb, and that had beets in it.
There we go.
So yes.
Well
and
done.
And then actually one of my signature dishes that I have, I find my signature dish, I do this goat cheese panna cotta dish with roasted beets, a beet mascarpone puree, a little bit of balsamic. And so I serve that dish as well, which also I've won a competition with as well. So.
Oh, you're killing me. All right, hey, let's go to the phones. And we got Fred joining us from Newbury. Hi, Fred.
Hi, morning.
Morning.
Hey, I attended the Culinary Institute of America, but I was forced out because I couldn't find the time.
I don't get the joke, Fred.
You know, I'm a chef. It's a cooking school. I was going to be a chef, but I couldn't find the time.
All right. Thanks, Fred.
Got it.
So let's move on to... another recommendation from your menu at Black Flannel. Oh, Thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, Thyme.
Yeah, I got that. Yeah, that was a good joke.
All right. Fred, we'll let Fred back on the air then. But tell us another recommendation at Black Flannel that you have for people.
Yeah, right now we have this amazing dish. So we do this, it's a braised and smoked octopus, baby octopus dish, that we serve with a little bit of, it was like a warm fingerling potato salad and then a little mole and, little pickled mustard seed that we have on there, which is what actually really, really popular dish. And then another one we have, kind of a tuna, carpaccio with a little pineapple and jalapeno, with a little, mango gelée on there. So again, you know, it shows that it's not really kind of traditional brew pub fare.
Right.
But you know, you can't tell. People come here, and this is what's so unique about, you know, Black Flannel is that, you know, people come here for the amazing beer, the amazing distillery. And now we've got, you know, we're becoming a culinary destination, and that's really my goal. Is to help support this business and, you know, push the boundaries of what traditional pub serves.
Well, one thing that's really exciting when you do eat at Black Flannel is the suggested beer pairings that you offer guests. So what are you looking for when you're creating those pairings, Christian?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of two parts, you know. I work with Dan, and Dan, who's the head brewer here, and then Dave in the distillery. Mm-hmm. You know, I work with them on a daily basis, including beer, whether it's, you know, a main ingredient in my dish or it's a supporting flavor or how I can pair my food with the beer and spirits. So, you know, that's one of the greatest appeals of why I took this opportunity, because, you know, my background before I came here was really wine and food driven. And to have this experience, and it's really kind of opened my mind on kind of flavor profiling and pairings with alcohol in general, that it's more than, you know, beer is more than just a complement to food. It really can pair well with the flavor profiles between the ingredients in the food and the ingredients in the beer.
Yeah. Now, this is one of those menus when I go there that I don't care what I order. I could throw a dart at it or have the wait staff just pick something and bring it out to me. But it's an exciting menu, not a bland menu, as you've described some of these dishes. So how do you design a menu, you know, that will ensure that everyone will have a number of options to choose from without one of those 30-page menus coming to the table?
No, sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a couple things. One, I recognize that we are a brewery and distillery. So I recognize that people want to come here and have amazing spirits and beer. And so, you know, there's foods that they particularly want, whether it's snacks or just the burger or some fries, you know, but there's a lot of people that also want to come here for pairing. They want to try the flight and have, you know, little snacks or other food with it. And then I feel there are a lot of people now that come here because they see what we're doing, what we've created. So it kind of sets this bar of, okay, what can I serve that's going to complement still the beer and the spirits, but also allow us to be creative. So when I look at the menu itself, a lot of it is stuff that I've done before that I'm going to do differently, or that, you know, I read tons of cookbooks on a daily basis, so I draw inspiration from them. And then I have this huge whiteboard in my kitchen that the staff, I have a section on there, that I leave for anybody that has any kind of creative idea that they'd like to try. So that's where, you know, our menu changes weekly, where a couple of dishes on the menu are inspired actually by my staff. And wow. So I sit down with them and we talk about the recipe. We talk about kind of the direction they want to go in. And I just kind of help, you know, hone that and mold it. And then ultimately the next week we'll put on the menu, and it just,
Christian, we've got to leave it right there. We've got to just—we've teased people enough; they've got to get to Black Flannel Brewing. Hey, best of luck with James Beard. Thanks for being on.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News. Then we'll be back to learn about milkweed. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds, from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Several years back, there was a company in Quebec developing uses for milkweed, from the stuffing and winter parkas to using it to soak up oil spills. They hoped people would plant milkweed to help the monarch butterflies and then provide materials for the products that they plan to make. But should we be planting plenty more milkweed out there? What are the economic and ecological impacts of growing more in our environment? A team of researchers at UVM looked at this idea, and we've got a couple of them with us this morning. Joining me is Eva Kinnebrew of the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources and the Gunn Institute for Environment. Eva, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And Heather Darby is with us, an agronomy specialist for UVM Extension. Heather, great to have you here as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got questions for our guests about milkweed and their research, you can call us 802-244-1777 or 877-291-8255. And you can always email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Eva, to begin with, what is milkweed?
Well, milkweed is a plant that we often think about with its association with monarch butterflies. So it's a native plant to North America, and I think one of the exciting things I guess, that frames this research, perhaps it's not very exciting, kind of disappointing, is that it's been in decline in the last couple of decades. So the area of milkweed in the United States, for example, has declined by over 60%, and that is hugely problematic for monarch butterflies.
What types of areas does milkweed like to grow in?
Milkweed is a pretty good grower. So it doesn't grow necessarily like in dense forests. I think it prefers more sunny areas, but you can find it in a lot of grassland field settings. You'll find it in a lot of agricultural fields and disturbed areas, areas that have lots of sort of land use transitions. It's pretty good at growing in a lot of places.
Heather, do we know why that milkweed has been in decline across the country?
Yeah, I mean, much of milkweed's habitat is often agricultural settings. And I think in an agricultural setting, often milkweed is, based on its name, considered a weed. So it's constantly trying to be eradicated from agricultural systems. And, as a result of that, I'm, sure that has also been linked to less in the landscape as well.
Have we seen that same type of decline here in Vermont, Heather?
I'm not sure, and Eva may know better if there has been an assessment done on milkweed populations in the state of Vermont and whether or not that has declined or increased over time. We have had, many fields across the state going out of agriculture, but not necessarily, reverting back to natural settings, but maybe going to home, houses and things like that. So I'm not entirely sure, to be honest. And Eva, I'm not sure if you know.
Yeah, I would agree that I haven't seen any formal assessments, but there's a lot of common land use transitions in Vermont. For example, just converting natural areas to urban areas or natural areas to agriculture, which are kind of key transitions that get rid of milkweed in the process.
And Eva, what is the purpose of the pod and that fairy floss inside?
Yeah, so if you see a milkweed pod, growing, you can split it open. And as Rick just said, there's this really beautiful, fluffy substance inside. And if you look closely, each of those little fluffy bits has a seed attached to it. And so the purpose of that fluffy stuff, the floss that now we're marketing, is that it actually helps propel the seed and carry it in the wind to far distances. And that helps the plant reproduce and disperse.
I'm going to ask you each this question from your own area of study. So, Heather, what was the study that you conducted on milkweed recently?
Yeah, so, the goal of our research was to learn how to grow milkweed as a commercial agricultural crop. So all of our studies were really focused on how do we plant the crop, how do we grow it? How do we seed it? What kind of equipment? When? What's the best timing? All the way to management. Does it need to be fertilized? What kind of yields can we obtain? And then, how to harvest it commercially, how to store it. And then, in partnership with other researchers, we also looked at pollinators and what types of pollinators were visiting this crop and when, so that we could develop our, agronomic practices in concert with the benefits that we get from milkweed, not against them.
And Heather, can I make the assumption then that milkweed has not or has very very little been raised as a commercial crop before this?
Yeah, at least in Vermont, it's never been raised as a commercial crop. And, you know, there have been efforts in a couple other states in the United States to try to also look at commercialization. But that is correct. And that information does not exist because it hasn't been done.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And Eva, what was your area of this study that you were researching?
Yeah, so my research interests are kind of broadly about biodiversity in agriculture. And in my dissertation work at University of Vermont, I've focused on all the biodiversity that you can find in soils. And so within this milkweed system, we were already thinking about pollinators and monarch butterflies. And I kind of came in with an interest in those soil organisms like ants or beetles, earthworms, those sorts of things, and ask the question, how will biodiversity under milkweed compare to biodiversity under other common crops in Vermont? And that's kind of an important question because it helps us understand, for example, if we transition cornfields to milkweed fields, will there be a loss in biodiversity, or will the community of organisms just completely changed.
Oh, brilliant. Let's take a call. We've got Kathleen joining us from the Adirondacks over in New York State. Hi, Kathleen. Go right ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I listen to your show every single day.
Thank
but
you.
I have a comment. I live in the Adirondack State Park. We live on 300 acres. And behind the house is about 10 acres of blueberries and low bush, and we leave them alone. And on the other side of the house is about 10 acres of milkweed. And in the summertime, it's just dotted with orange. I mean, dotted. If you go out to the car, it'll land right on your shoulder, a monarch. So we don't do anything for fertilizing. We just don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the summer, we brush hog once with the tractor. At the very end, just to keep, you know, the little trees from growing. And then they all come back. We've never fertilized it. We've never used it. We've had this farm for 35 years. We've never done anything in that field except let milkweed grow.
Thank you, Kathleen, from all the monarch butterflies in the world.
thank you for your program. I wouldn't miss it, never. It keeps me company. It's my friend.
Oh, Kathleen, thank you so much.
Good day.
All right, you too. Wow, so that's a great world right there. 10 acres of milkweed that just comes back year in and year out. And I don't know who wants to take this, but you know, we want to protect that and keep those, right? But the idea is now to see how we expand on this and commercialize the milkweed crop throughout the country and in Vermont. Heather?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned as you were opening the program about the prior market that existed in Quebec, the growing market for milkweed floss. And the floss, again, was going to be utilized in a whole variety of products. And unfortunately, that market went away pretty suddenly. And so we were making some momentum in the state of Vermont with a few local farms to begin to grow the milkweed as a crop that could be harvested. Again, you know, part of the appeal of the crop to many is the fact that it has these very valuable insulating properties, but it also has or could have this major ecological benefit to monarchs and other pollinators and to the soil itself. And so really it's a crop that was looked at as a potential win-win on a lot of fronts. And but you need a market in order for, you know, sort of that work to continue to, you know, present the crop as something that could be grown commercially on a farm. And that market, unfortunately, doesn't exist at that time. So our efforts, at least in the local farming landscape, have been a bit curtailed at this point.
And Eva, as Kathleen mentioned, the monarchs just flocking to her 10 acres of milkweed. What is it? Why do monarchs love the milkweed?
Yeah, well, monarch butterflies rely on milkweed for their reproductive cycles. So the monarch butterflies look for milkweed to lay their eggs on, and those eggs hatch into caterpillars, and those caterpillars are one of the few organisms that can actually eat milkweed, because milkweed is actually quite toxic. If you have milkweed in your garden, sometimes you break a leaf off, you'll notice that some sap will come out, maybe you get it on your hand, and it actually starts to itch or burn. So that's because the sap within milkweed is toxic as a defense mechanism. But the milkweed caterpillars, or sorry, the monarch caterpillars can actually eat that and thrive. And so that's why the monarch is so attracted to those milkweed fields.
Ah, nature. And we have the phones lit up. So I want to make sure first we do get to hear the results that you did ascertain from the study, and then we'll get to the calls. So, Eva, what did you learn from the study that was important for what you were exploring?
Yeah, so, again, I looked at the soil biodiversity under milkweed, but also under corn, hay, and forest, because corn and hay are the two most common agricultural land uses in Vermont, and then forest is obviously the natural cover of Vermont. And basically we found that milkweed diversity is very similar to hay diversity. And at the same time, milkweed diversity was higher than corn diversity, but usually lower than the forest. So that really what that means is that if you convert fields from corn to milkweed, you're probably going to see a diversity gains. If you convert between hay and milkweed, probably neutral gains. But if you convert a forest field to milkweed, you might actually end up lowering your diversity.
Interesting. Now, Heather, you looked at how to grow this as a commercial crop, and what did you find?
Well, a whole number of results, but we found that milkweed was actually quite difficult to establish, which, you know, we all were pretty shocked at considering how invasive it can be within fields and how quickly it can spread once you have it. And, you know, thinking about the woman that called in saying they have 10 acres of it. And so farmers were really shocked that it was actually quite difficult to get going from seed. And oftentimes, once it would seed, once we planted it, it would be almost 3 years before we would really see enough plants to be a viable stand. So that was one major take-home message.
All right, let's get to Brian, who's joining us from Eden. Hi, Brian. Go right ahead.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Great show, by the way, yesterday from Joe's Pond.
Thanks.
I'll give you a call next week during open phones.
Okay.
As far as milkweeds go, I'm so glad you're having the show because I love milkweed. The only commercial use I ever heard of people growing it in Vermont was during World War II. They grew it to use it to stuff life vests, I guess, for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only, my grandparents were extremely easygoing people, but I remember the biggest no-no. They caught me blowing, you know, the parachutes when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And they were the easiest, most easygoing, nice people. But, boy, farmers did not like milkweed back then.
That's right. And you were spreading
it. I got in huge trouble for doing that.
I can imagine.
Caught doing that. But I'm glad they're changing, you know, the vibe about it because it really was looked down on.
Yeah.
So,
all right. Thanks, Brian, for that. Cindy, you're up next. Go right ahead. Cindy and Faiston.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Two comments. One's on the beets. I cooked some beets last night or the night before, and I roast them. They were really big beets in the grocery store, and I felt them. They felt really nice and heavy. I could tell they were good. And I washed them off.
Sounds like we lost Cindy. Cindy's referring to our last guest, Chef Christian Cruz, who loves to incorporate beets in a lot of his dishes. Let's go on to Forbes. And Forbes, how are you doing?
Hi, great, great. One of our big problems is everyone wants a pristine backyard, and they wind up mowing down all of the wildflowers and the other pollinators milkweed too.
Yep.
And that hurts. I grow blueberries, and blueberry blossoms are tubular, and the bumblebee and the monarchs are the only ones that will pollinate blueberries. So they're so essential for a good crop.
Yeah. Forbes, I'm going to ask Eva to tell us a little bit more about that. Eva, Forbes mentioning how important it is to kind of have that diversity in our yards for the pollinators. So what kind of advice can you give people, you know, instead of just clearing something that we think of a weed sometimes, like the milkweed, how important it is to keep that as part of your outside landscape for the pollinators?
Yeah, well, so I'm definitely not a pollinator expert, though I work amongst many.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that Forbes is completely right in that plants have very specific flowers often that can only be pollinated by certain pollinators. And so basically what that means is that if you just have one kind of flower in your entire garden, then you're probably not going to have that big of a diversity of pollinators because there's just nothing there to attract them.
Yeah.
On the other side, if you plant a whole variety of different kinds of flowers, then you're going to attract a whole bigger range of organisms to your yard.
Love it. All right. We are getting a lot of calls. I'm going to try to get them in here. Harry's joining us from Royalton. Hi, Harry.
Howdy. I was curious. Dairy farmers never liked milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that a cow takes a mouthful of hay and chews it all up, but they'll throw the milkweed aside. Now, and they will not eat milkweed that grows on the hillside in their pasture.
Mm-hmm.
So is it toxin
to cows,
cattle?
Harry, great question. Heather, I'll put that one to you. So cows not loving the milkweed, they'll eat all the grass. Is it a toxic reaction that cows have to milkweed?
Well, yes, it's an adversity, you know, similar to what Eva already mentioned, that latex, you know, that sort of material that comes out of the milkweed that everybody says, right, the milk.
Yep.
Is abrasive to the cows. They don't like it, just like people don't like it. It's bitter. You know, it could maybe cause a little discomfort around their mouths if they get a lot of it on there. So it's a learned behavior, you know, that yep. You don't eat the milkweed because of that milky latex that, you know, is not flavorful and yummy like the rest of the grass around there, but it's not the milkweed we have here in Vermont would not necessarily, you know, cause a mortality in a cow, but there are some milkweeds that are much more toxic than the ones that we have here.
All right. I will tell you, Eva and Heather, this is the most calls I've gotten in a half hour, and I still have somebody on hold. So you've certainly struck a chord with your milkweed research here in Vermont. So continue to go forth and publish and research more because people are very interested. Eva Kinnebrew of the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources and the Gund Institute for Environment, Heather Darby of UVM Extension. Thank you so much for being on. Very interesting discussion this morning.
Thank you, Rick. It's been great.
Thank you.
Take care. And I know we only got probably about a tenth of what they've learned. We're going to take a top-of-the-hour news break, come back with Bob Day, our national correspondent. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and we have national correspondent Bob Ney with us to get some perspective on what's happening in the world this week. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Bob, I actually was going to retire doing the COVID numbers. I didn't want to tempt fate, and then then I heard about the Omicron variant BA2, and I thought, this is not the week. So why don't you run the numbers for us, Bob?
I'll take your signal when you're ready to retire. Obviously the deaths, all deaths are bad, 970,000, which is a good portion of the world's 6 million for our population, you know, per capita. But good news is 28% down on the cases, the vaccinations, unfortunately 65.2%, which is, you know, 65.2% is not the 70 or 75 we wanted, but boosters are worse. It's 49.9%. Hospitalizations, good news, 27% decrease, and the deaths have decreased 25%. So it's better than it was, yep. No question about that.
Bob, what do we know about this BA2 variant?
Well, from what they're saying, I should go back to the original articles, because yesterday I saw the articles and I thought, okay, here we go again. You know, it was warnings and things. But now, and, you know, what you just had, the clip you had on there, they feel that the booster shots will help with it. Doesn't seem like it's going to be, you know, severe. Omicron ended up, of course, not to be severe. It kind of followed statistically what South Africa, you know, went through with it. So we don't know that much more yet, but it just doesn't seem to be kind of the forward panic that Omicron had.
And will we be rolling up our sleeves for dose number 4, booster number 2?
And number 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10.
Right.
But when this all started, I had a physical, and I had another physical about 2 weeks ago, and I reminded my doctor 2 years ago. My doctor turned to me. He said, they'll develop a vaccine, and we will get boosters every year. He told me that.
Yeah.
And I reminded him of his wisdom at the time. He knew something that I didn't.
Yeah. So much like the flu shot, we'll just.
I think so.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Yeah. No problem with that. All right. Speaking of COVID, the COVID border policies, what have they been, and what's the future of these?
You know, the Ukraine, and I'm glad you asked about this, because the Ukraine news, which is, you know, it's horrific what's going on there, and obviously it dominates the news, and I understand that, but there's a lot of different things that are going on around the world and the United States that are, you know, that are big. And it's one of those things that once the Ukraine hopefully settles down or something happens, then you're going to see potentially a lot of news turned towards COVID and the border, because what has happened is the Trump policy with the border was to step in with border policy, and people, you know, during the COVID, during the pandemic, Trump was basically stopping people from coming here.
Mm-hmm.
Border officials have used what's called Title 42 more than 1 million times to expel migrants at the southern border. Think about that. More than 1 million times, Rick, they've used what's called Title 42, and that's without hearing asylum claims. Now, the president's being pressured right now to basically get rid of that entire process. Now, his own intelligence officials, you know, from the agency, are privately bracing for a potential influx of more than 170,000 people at the Mexico border if the COVID Trump era policies that allow instant expulsions during this public health crisis are undone. So who knows? But if they are undone, and the president hasn't decided to do that yet, now we all know, Rick, he decides not to do that, he's going to get some heat from the squad and others that you know are very concerned about this issue. If he undoes it and 170,000 people or more or near that rush to the border, then you can bet around May or June, president's going to have a whole different set of heartburn.
Yeah, and it should be noted that you've kind of implied this, but it has been kept in place by President Biden. So
yes,
he certainly could have moved to rescind Title 42, but has kept that in place, and that has kind of slowed the influx of immigrants from the southern border. So how might Homeland Security deal with this spring influx, you know, if it is removed? And spring is a time when there would be more movement as well at the border, right?
Right. And the department basically would have to bring in additional personnel. Now, they're saying hundreds or thousands of additional personnel from the Customs and Border Protection. They'll have to take them from what we call ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. A lot of people know that name. Mm-hmm. They'll have to take them from Transportation Security Administration, Citizenship and Immigration Services, and medical personnel from the Department of Health and Human Services. So they're also talking about requesting aircraft from the U.S. Marshal Service. They would have to build new soft-sided facilities. Soft-sided would be basically temporary.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be to house up to 2,000 migrants apiece. Now, once you talk about this, I do remember, at least at that time, and we have inflation now, statistically it was costing about, I think for a family, $750 to $1,200 a day of costs for a, you know, for a family that they're housing. So start to think about all of that. They'll need all those resources, and you can bet they're going to have to say, we need money.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
They're going to need money.
Oh, boy. All right. That's what we can look forward to in the spring ahead. Now, let's move to Ukraine, Bob. The Putin machine getting more aggressive in the attack there, even attacking citizens. Will he stop till he has taken out Zelensky?
You know, I would still argue that he is. People have argued he's mentally ill now, and he's like Kim Jong-un, and he's completely removed from reality. I don't believe that's the case. Yeah. I think he's brutal. I think he has become unhinged, maniacal. Just into full dictator mode.
Mm-hmm.
He's not only bombing, wherever he pleases, apartment buildings and hospitals, et cetera, taking people out in the street and killing them. We had an American killed 2 days ago who was in a bread line and was shot by Russian soldiers. So he's doing what he pleases. Of course, Ukraine is not taking the sitting down. Well, President Biden issued $1 billion to help them. There's other discussions about no-fly zones, and maybe additional aircraft. So they're fighting back. But I do want to note this. His language, Putin, has become definitely Stalin-like. Mm-hmm. He's talking about gnats that go in your mouth. And he said this at his press conference, and you spit them out. He's going after his own people. Four planes left yesterday to Dubai. Thousands of people are trying to get out of Russia. He's going after the, quote, traitors who have boats in Miami. He's talking about the influence of homosexuality in the West, and they want to bring it to Russia. I mean, he's just going the full gambit mm-hmm. of trying to scare and sell the Russian people on this, terrible thing he's doing. But he's also going after Russians. He's saying there has to be a realignment in Russia. Putin is personally not only, trying to create genocide against the Ukrainians and do what he's doing, but on top of it, Rick, he's going after his own country. He's taken this backwards to a whole new level.
And let's talk about Stalin. You said he's starting to speak like Stalin, the things he's saying. Sometimes we forget, World War II and the focus is on, the atrocities of Germany and Hitler. But the brutal reign of Stalin, right?
Yes. Very brutal.
Yeah. There have been peace talks. Are they for show? Something might actually come out of that between Russia and Ukraine?
I think the important thing about the peace talks, Rick, is that they're going on. They're continuing. They're not stopping. Are they getting somewhere? Not in particular. But having them still active is far better in case this, breaks apart. President Biden is pushing the Chinese. The Chinese are just about the only people Putin has left in this world. Mm-hmm. Now, India also is very interdependent and reliant. Unfortunately, India doesn't like it, but they're relying on Russia for military armaments to protect them against China and Pakistan. But, I mean, India's not in their heart, you know, supporting Russia, but China is, and China can provide armaments and money. So President Biden, I guarantee you today, is going to do a full court press to try to get the Chinese to back off, which would definitely hurt Putin.
Mm-hmm. National correspondent Bob Day, thank you so much for your time. Great perspective. Always enlightening. All right, take care. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. She's covered everything from sports to news, arts to food throughout her writing career. But I know one of her favorite things is to write about our wonderful chefs. And in this week's 7 days, Sally Pollock has the cover story with a great feature on Chef Frank Pace. And she joins us now. Sally, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks.
You do love these doing these profiles on chefs, don't you?
Yes, and doing one on Frank is especially, you know, gratifying and fun to do because, if you know Frank, he's just a really neat person and always great to talk to Frank.
Yeah. Well, what got Frank started in the restaurant biz?
So Frank grew up in Ludlow, which is a town in southern Vermont, on a dirt road, and his mother was a high school teacher and his father first worked, you know, Stewart Dairy, which is sort of a well-known dairy that's been in Rutland forever. His father managed Stewart's and then in 1982 opened a little sort of diner-style restaurant called The Hatchery. And Frank, as a kid, you know, middle school kid, started working there, washing dishes, slicing meat, cutting vegetables. And that's where he got into restaurants.
Now, give us some highlights of his resume of places beyond the Hatchery where we would know Frank Pace from.
Well, if people who lived in Burlington in the early 90s would know him from Sweet Tomatoes, which was where Pascolo is now on Church Street, a sort of subterranean restaurant. And it was a happening spot back then with chicken-shaped pitchers. I never quite knew what they were, but ceramic pitchers that, at least at my table, were filled with red wine and really good bread, I remember, to dunk in garlicky olive oil. And Frank was one of the cooks there. I guess you'd call him a line cook. And he made pizzas. He did one of the sort of known, well-known dishes there was a pasta with tomato sauce, sautéed shrimp, and horseradish. Mm. And, like, what was that? I don't know, 30 years ago or something? And, you know, Frank's like, yeah, that was awesome, that meal. So you might know him from there. Then he went out to San Francisco to cooking school, culinary school. And if you went to any Grateful Dead shows, you might have run into Frank there.
That's right.
And he cooked in San Francisco for about 7 or 8 years at restaurants that Californians would know. And came back here and was at Nico's for a while and Smoke Jack's and the place that replaced Sweet Tomatoes, which was called Three Tomatoes. So
that time he spent in San Francisco, what kind of influence did that have on his culinary skills and sensibilities?
Well, the Bay Area was sort of early and influential in farm-to-table dining, partly just the climate, the weather that's so near, so much great produce. So that was really the standard way that chefs were using food and cooking with food. And so when Frank, that was what he did out there, part of what he did was really making use of locally raised products. And when he came back to Vermont in the early 2000s, that was sort of just taking off. And as a native Vermonter, he was very, you know, aware of and sort of tuned in to the fact that he saw the agriculture scene sort of changing and diversifying, moving away from dairy, which obviously is still here, and towards smaller diversified produce farms and locally raised meat and stuff like that. And that was really important for Frank. Like he said, that's what inspires chefs the ingredients. And so sort of the three things, I guess, throughout his career that kind of hold true across the decades are locally, finding ingredients as close to home as possible. We're enjoying the people you work with and having fun while you do it. So that's his sort of kitchen approach.
Now, another thing that he's really become known for is the meat cutting. How did you develop that skill?
So Frank, after he worked at Smoke Jack's, which is where Honey Road is now, yep. And Eric Warmstead was a lot of people we've all sort of, the food restaurant people might know about. A lot of them worked at Smoke Jack's, actually.
Fabulous place.
Eric Warmstead was a chef there, and he left to open Hen of the Wood in Waterbury. I think it was 2005, and Frank replaced him. And after he worked at Smoke Jack's, he went to work at Shelburne Supermarket, and he was there in sort of two stints as the produce manager and then in the meat department. And he learned meat cutting and butchery, and I think he really was – it was important to him at that point in his career to really learn a new kind of craft and focus in on that. And he's well known now in Vermont for that skill. He went on to work at Healthy Living, and one of the owners there, Nina Lesser Goldsmith, told me that he really created what she called a sophisticated meat department, and that some of the methods and that Frank put in place, a decade ago, remained. Things like value added, using the whole animal, his sausage recipes, and just sort of his standards for sourcing and for products are still in use at Healthy Living.
Mm. Now, most recently, people will know him from Great Northern at Zero Gravity. So describe the restaurant there and its offerings under Frank.
So Frank and his wife, Marnie Long, who they've known for back to Sweet Tomato days, she was a busser there and went on to work. She worked there off and on for 13 years, but they met there and became sort of friends, buddies, and then roommates, and then life partners. They have two kids, elementary school age kids, and they have both, they're extremely experienced and have done everything you can imagine in restaurants. And they opened their first restaurant at the Great Northern, which is right next to Zero Gravity Brewery on Pine Street in the south end of Burlington, in 2017, Mother's Day weekend. And it was sort of paired with Zero Gravity. And Frank made a menu that was sort of certainly his own, but kind of meant, I think, sort of designed to work with the beers. And also made food sort of more kind of regular old hot doggy food type food, and sausage and fries and wings for the brewery. So that was his and Marnie's first restaurant that was theirs. And not long, just a few years after they opened it, of course, COVID came and restaurants were all shut down, and they switched to a takeout model. And through all that, I should say, those guys were caterers. Their kind of first, one of their gigs that they've been doing all along is catering, and they're sort of catered, weddings and events, and so that was, now that's being run out of the Great Northern.
Now, they just made a big move, and that is to purchase August 1st Bakery and Cafe in Burlington. Give us a brief description of that place.
So August 1st was started, I think, about 12 years ago or so by a married couple named Jody Whalen and Phil Merrick. And it's sort of near the waterfront, between downtown and the waterfront in Burlington. And it's a converted garage. And it's just a really, sort of casual counter service cafe. It's got an affiliated bakery that makes great breads, baguettes and sandwich loaves and, country French bread. And it's got pastries and croissants and really great maple biscuits. I think I once measured mine before I ate it because it's so high. I was so, you cut it in half and neither side fits in the toaster, that kind of. And they're keeping that. And they're keeping everything, and sandwiches and soups. It's just a very casual, in the summer there's a bicyclist who cycles around Burlington selling bread and brownies and stuff. And it's sort of somewhat known for having no Wi-Fi. It's a computer-free place. And it's quite different in style, let's say, from Zero Gravity, which is in this huge renovated, you know, sort of fancy, ornate space with a I like to sit at the bar for one reason, because Jimi Hendrix, the bar came from Seattle in a bar room where Jimi Hendrix played. So, you know, you can always think of that when you're there. And it's also just a great place. So Frank and Marnie have these two spots, you know, about a mile apart from each other, and they're running them both. And between the two, they're serving food from, you know, 7:30 in the morning till 9 at night. And one thing that's really, you know, I sort of want to mention about Frank that is really, I think a lot of people told me stands out. He's I guess you'd call him an executive chef. He cooks every day. Okay. He's not just like doing inventory, purchasing, managing people. If you eat food at those places, you're eating food made by Frank. And in his first weeks at August 1st, you know, he's making breakfast sandwiches. He's making specials. He's making banh mi, you know, he's cleaning the coolers. He's at least he says he is. Anyway, you know, he's and Lahi Ibrahim, his sous chef or chef de cuisine at the Great Northern, just said that. You know, one thing I love about Frank is he never stops cooking, and they all, I think he creates kitchens. The people who work with him say that, you know, Frank's kitchens are really collaborative and just really people really like to work there. He's a natural teacher and people work well with him and together.
Sally, we've got about 30 seconds. This seems like an odd mix, but why the purchase of August 1st?
Well, I think that they, you know, there's a new arrangement at the Great Northern where they're sort of providing the food and not doing front of the house, so it allowed them the opportunity, and it fits well with their schedule. And one thing I should add about Frank, and he's a deadhead. And for me, I've written a lot of stories, but this is the first one that turned me into a deadhead. So I'm personally thankful to Frank because all I do is listen to The Grateful Dead.
How about that? Wow. He's an influencer. All right. Sally Pollock.
Yes, he is. I'm back in 1970. It's great.
I love it. All right. You can read Sally Pollock's story in this week's issue of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Sally, great having you on. Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye.
Take care. The new deadhead, Sally Pollock. We're going to take a break for news, and then we'll return to meet Bolton artist Natasha Bogar. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. We began this week with harp music, and on Wednesday we had poetry. So I think it's only appropriate to finish with some outstanding artwork. And a shout out to Pam in Duxbury, one of our listeners, for suggesting that I invite our next guest on the show. Joining me now is painter Natasha Bogar. Natasha, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you'd like to browse some of Natasha's work while we talk, you can go to NatashaBogar.com and take a look at it. And if you have a question for Natasha, or if you're a fan of her work, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Natasha, what initially fueled your interest in painting?
I think I've been painting for as long as I can remember. I have a twin sister. She was also really into artwork as a child, and we just kept going with it. And I ended up majoring in art in college, and just never stopped.
Was it a competitive thing with your sister or a complimentary thing with your sister, your twin?
No, yeah, complimentary. And in the past, we have collaborated and worked on projects together, like big murals or artists in residency programs in schools. And we've written grants to do public art projects with kids. And she lives in Maine now, so we don't collaborate as frequently as we used to. But it's always been a friendly, non-competitive relationship.
All right, good. Now, you used two different methods of painting. One is plein air. Explain what that is.
Sure. Plein air is French for out in the open air as your eye directly sees. So that's when you set up outdoors and paint what you see versus taking photos and working in your studio, which I also do that as well, especially in the winter. The plein air is a little more challenging.
And when you do plein air, is that watercolors that you're doing?
Generally, yep, because watercolors are much easier to transport and they dry quickly. Sometimes I'll do acrylics outside if I'm looking for more of a painting on canvas result, then I'll use acrylics. I've not used oils out in plein air painting because it's such a expensive setup for oil painting. It's much easier to control in a studio setting.
Yeah, and so when you're in the studio, you are using oils. So how much different is that from, you know, the watercolors? How difficult is it to switch between the two?
I don't find it difficult, but it is a completely different method.
Mm-hmm.
They are a little bit similar in that they're both very fluid in nature, and I really enjoy how oil paints don't dry up on you. So if my daughter needs help with something, I can leave my easel, go make a snack, do some things, come back down, and my paints are still wet, and I can keep going, which I really like versus acrylics dry up quickly, and I find that frustrating sometimes. To have your piles of paint dry up on you when you get distracted.
Yeah. Now, I said two methods. Maybe it's three, because you also have a love for painting murals, as you mentioned, which seems like another discipline altogether with a whole new set of skills. So, you know, what is the difference between doing a canvas, doing plein air, or doing a mural on the side of a building?
Yes. So murals, generally, I use more of like a acrylic or latex-based paint for walls because generally that's what goes well on a wall. It's more of that style of paint. I will generally make a design before I do a mural, though, and the design I'll do in watercolor or acrylics. And then I guess the biggest difference with the murals, it's just such a bigger size that your brushes are bigger, and you have to really back up and see what you're doing. Quite often, you need to like take a step back to get the big picture because it's easy to get, you know, lost in the details. And so it's important to, you know, step back frequently. Whereas when you're working on a canvas in the studio, that's not as much of a big deal because it's not so oversized.
I wondered how you muralists do it because, like you said, when you're working on a canvas, you could just take a step back. You could see your entire painting. But when you're doing a mural, you know, which covers the side of a wall or something, it has got to be quite a challenge to always know where you are and maintaining your proportions, et cetera.
That's true. And then you're also using ladders. And so it's definitely more challenging, but it's also really fun to work on a large scale like that. You know, it's just different. So I think that's something that I like, is having a feeling of freshness, like not always working the same medium or doing the same thing. I like having the variety. It keeps my interest and attention a little more engaged when I'm not always doing the exact same thing.
Now, Natasha, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I do a bit of stained glass, not a lot, but when I do, it's always kind of refreshing to not be painting and doing a different art form.
I love it. Now, I know nothing about you, but I think I ascertained pretty quickly from your paintings that you love skiing. So what am I, first of all, am I right? Did I nail that?
Yes, that's true.
What type of skiing do you enjoy?
Well, if you saw my studio, it's also our ski mudroom, and you would see every kind of ski out there. So I do like to do your traditional cross-country skiing, classic and skate, and then I love downhill skiing and telemark skiing and backcountry skiing. So it really, the weather dictates my choice and what kind of skiing I'm up to. We live at Bolton Valley at the resort. We bought we moved up here about 12 years ago, and we live in a three-story townhouse, and the lower level of our unit is my studio. So it's also where we ski in and out of. It's a great space. Got really high ceilings, and we do, some teaching in there and a lot of artwork. It's sort of like a little art center on the mountain.
Slopeside Studio is the perfect place for you, Natasha. How often do you get out on the mountain in a typical winter?
Again, it's weather dependent, as you know. Weather is so fickle here.
Sure.
But when it's good, I try to get out a lot because the season goes by quickly. And when it's good, it's good.
Yeah.
When it's not, not. But, and that doesn't mean I'll go out all day either. That's sort of the spoiled nature of living up here, is I can just go out for an hour or two if I want and then go back to work. So it's sort of a nice balance of not feeling the pressure of needing to go skiing all day long, but just being able to go out and get some fresh air and some exercise and then refocus on my work.
Well, let's take a call from the person who recommended that I have you on the air, which is Pam from Duxbury. Good morning, Pam.
Hey, Rick. Hey, Natasha. We've exchanged emails. I'm thrilled to hear you on the show. So my son took me to Stowe Street Cafe one day, and your artwork was on display there, and it took my breath away, all these landscapes of the great outdoors, Vermont and Maine, where, as you know, my sister and I grew up. We're both in Vermont now, but it just... We're a very outdoor-oriented family, and your snowscapes and your summerscapes and Mount Katahdin. I really encourage people to take a look at your website and just see the width and breadth of your beautiful take on our great outdoors.
Yeah, Pam, great call. Thank you so much. Natasha, Pam has really got it. In addition to painting trails, ski resorts, tell us about some of the other things that you do love to paint.
Yes. I like all seasons. We lived in Hawaii for a while, but we came back because we missed seasons. in the summers, we're out on the lakes a lot, and I just absolutely love the lighting, and especially around the morning and evening sunset hour, you get really special effects. And so that's kind of what I like to capture, those moments where the light's hitting the mountains in a really funny way, and it doesn't last long. So I end up taking a lot of photos for future reference in hopes of being able to paint some of them. When I do paint from photos, I generally will work from four or more references because I like to do sort of a mashup or a combination of things I've seen. So I feel like it makes my art a little more, hyper-realism, where it's realistic looking, but there's also sort of this element of narrative, almost like a, like when I do a snowscape, I might add in some ski tracks and add in some extra things to make it a little more of a storied picture. So it's not always super realistic, especially with the way I like to enhance colors, but it lends itself to the imagination. And, that's the other thing, is the camera can't see as many colors or capture as many colors as your eye can see, but I can see millions of more colors than a camera can capture. So I feel like that's sort of the power of painting, is being able to bring that to a 2D image, those extra colors. I'm sure you've taken a picture of a sunset and looked at yes. your result and being like, that's just not what I'm seeing.
Right. Yeah, what happened there? Now, Natasha, I'm going to pretend, but I don't really know a whole lot. I'm not an art scholar or art historian. But when I see some of your winter scenes done in oil, I see a similarity to a Quebec artist by the name of Marc-Aurelier Fortin. Do you know his work, painted in the 20s through the 60s?
I feel like I need to check it out, though.
Well, I saw his work at the Musée des Beaux-Arts in Montreal. And when I see some of like the trees that you've done that are heavy with snow in the winter, I think, oh, she's got his same sensibility in capturing those winter scenes and just one side of the border to the other. So, yeah, Fortin.
What was his name again?
It's Fortin, F-O-R-T-I-N.
Okay.
Marc Fortin.
Yeah, look that up. Yeah, the winter scenes with the snowy branches and when the light hits them, those are one of those moments when I'm out there, I'm like, wow, that's amazing. I really mm-hmm. want to paint that. It's just one of those moments where you want to recreate it and on a bigger scale. And I think that's what I like about oil paintings is you can do large canvases.
Yeah. Now, the other thing I think anyone from away could look through your paintings of Vermont and they'd have a real outstanding idea of what this state is. So how easy is it for you to capture that soul of Vermont on canvas like you do?
You know, I think a lot of it comes out of a place of joy and, you know, having an outdoor lifestyle and being out in nature and those moments where you feel really happy from the things that you're seeing and the endorphins from exercising. And I think that's something that everyone can relate to is when they see an image like that. And even if, you know, if they have a disability and they can't hike, but being able to see the picture of those snowy trees on the top of the mountain in the middle of winter mm-hmm. is, it kind of brings you there, whether or not you can get there yourself. And I really enjoy that my paintings can help bring people joy and experience what I have seen and I think is special and being able to share that. I feel like it is gratifying for me to be able to do that.
What are some other subjects that you really enjoy painting?
Well, definitely landscapes, but I do enjoy doing animals and people. I've done at some pet portraits for people, and I always just like how much personality animals have and being able to translate that. And, you know, obviously pets are very special to their owners, and so it's always an honor to create a portrait that represents their love for their pet that may have passed. And I like that, being able to try to capture their essence or what made them special, whether it's the look in their eyes or the background, like maybe it's on top of Camel's Hump, those special places where people have spent time. So again, that's another way of helping bring joy to people is that. And and then I did a painting last year of my daughter and I ice skating on Gillette Pond in Huntington, mm-hmm. and that's been a really popular image this last year. And I think it, even though it's me and my daughter, it's still really special for other people that have had experiences skating there and, you know, bringing kids there. So that's nice as well to capture.
Now, Natasha, you also teach painting classes. Tell us about the different types of classes that you do teach.
Sure. I've been teaching this winter once a month up at Black Flannel in Essex, and that's a restaurant, a brewery, and distillery, and it's a very large space. It's up at the Essex Experience, and they took over a few outlet stores.
We had their chef on earlier this morning, Natasha.
Oh, it's so funny.
Yeah,
I really love it up there. It's a great crew, a great team up there, and they have an event room called the Barrel Room, so that's where we do the painting, and it's nice because you can go in and have your own table with your friends and family, and so everyone has space, which is great. And I co-teach with Cara Ware, who's another Fulton artist. She shares studio space with me, and we get along really well, and it's been fun to teach the classes with her because people are a little more spread out with the way we do things now post-COVID. She'll set up on one side of the room and demonstrate the painting while I set up on the other side and paint. So no matter where you are, you can see one of us demonstrating, and then we take turns instructing. And that's like a two-hour class, sort of Vermont landscapes and Vermont-inspired paintings with animals or flowers. And that's been very popular. I've been teaching sort of that paint and sip style of class where it's a guided course for about 2 hours, and you just go step by step. And it doesn't matter how much experience you have that you bring to the table. It's just like a fun activity to do with friends and family. And yeah, I feel like the way I do it, people find a lot of success. And so we get some repeat customers on that, which is nice. And then I also teach some private lessons out of the studio, people that really want to hone in on a certain type of art, whether it's acrylics or watercolors or stained glass. We do some stained glass workshops out of there. Yeah, and then that's pretty much it right now. Occasionally I'll do pop-up classes at different places. I used to teach at the Stowe Street Cafe before the pandemic. And I've done a few things with Zen Barn in Waterbury as well. Mm-hmm. Another great venue.
Do you try to paint every day at a specific time? Do you paint when the spirit moves you? What is your kind of routine?
That's a good question. I don't always have time to paint, you know, being a mom and running a household and teaching classes take a lot of time with the preparation that goes into it to make sure that it's a good class. And then also running the website and doing marketing. So when I actually have time to sit down and oil paint my easel, I feel really lucky. It's like a special moment I get excited about. And, you know, then I'm also stocking galleries with fine art prints and, you know, making various merchandise things for that. So it's kind of a juggling act, honestly. And I almost feel like instead of having a regular routine, I'll sort of do go all in on one of those activities for a while until it's done. And then I'll switch gears. And like if I start an oil painting, it's very difficult for me to stop and work on something else because I just want to finish it. So I guess I kind of jump from one thing to the other and I don't think it's random, but it's more of like what is mission critical to get done next, right, to make things work and happen.
But we can still hear the joy that you have in your voice for painting. Natasha Bogar is a painter whose works you can peruse at natashabogar.com. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was really fun to talk about and appreciate your time.
You're most welcome. All right, that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. And I also want to thank Stephen Tanzi for his help yesterday at our live remote broadcast at Joe's Pond. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com, sponsored by the Warren Store. Funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday when we get a State House update. We'll hear about the UVM Waffle Club. We'll chat with WDEV All-Star Brady Farkas and talk with UVM Professor of Russian Studies Kevin McKenna.